This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. 5 p.m. this Friday, January 6th. I'm Guy Johnson in London, alongside Alex Steele over in New York. You're listening to The Cable. We have made it to Friday. It has been a bumpy week thus far, and today certainly no exception. European equities absolutely flying. We're seeing a similar thing on Wall Street. We saw inflation coming down in Europe, but core inflation rising. So headline down, core rising. In the States, we've seen a really quite a sort of series of solid employment numbers this week. The payroll number today, really quite good. But what happened today was that within that day, so wages went down and the market, Alex, has reacted in an extraordinary way. Yes, equities are higher, but it's bond yields where the real story is. Bond yields are dropping massively.
Yeah, it's been really interesting because after the jobs number, it was status quo. You did get a big spike in bond yields and then we kind of moderated. Equities were higher and then we kind of moderated. But then a couple hours ago, we got the ISM services data, fell below 50 for the first time since May of 2020. So rolling over, yay, services rolling over, but also not falling out of bed, not terrible. And then equities just ripped, bond yields tanked. And that's kind of the story here. My takeaway is solid and slow.
Solid and slow, meaning what? I.e.,
the economy's still solid, but it is slowing.
Yeah. And that's good news or bad news for the Fed? How does that kind of position us?
I think it's a good news. Well, at least the market's taking it as a good news situation, that maybe they can downshift, they don't have to do as much. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying it looks like that's how the market's interpreting it.
Yeah, I think the sense seems to be certainly that the Fed can now, on the back of some of these numbers, downshift to a 25 basis point hiking cycle. The question is now, how long does that continue? Anyway, we'll debate that in just a moment. We have much to discuss: inflation data here in Europe, the payroll data over in the United States alongside the ISM services. We'll do that with Marcus Ashworth in just a moment. Before we get to Marcus, though, here's Charlie with the headlines.
Thank you very much. And here's what's going on, Guy Johnson. The boss of one of Britain's biggest transport unions is calling for coordinated strikes involving tens of thousands of public sector workers, including teachers, firefighters, and nurses, just as junior doctors consider joining the wave of industrial unrest. Mike Lynch, General Secretary of the National Union of Rail, Maritime, and Transport Workers, says, quote, "We need to maximize our influence and leverage up across hopefully everyone that's involved in a dispute." France, meanwhile, is ramping up the availability of its state-owned fleet of nuclear reactors after months of extended outages, and a sign of relief for Europe as it battles a historic energy crisis. And the UK is said to be set to reduce the level of support that it gives to businesses to help them with their soaring energy bills by 85% from April. This, according to The Telegraph. Citing sources, the newspaper said British firms currently benefit from a six-month program of energy aid ending in March worth £18 billion, which is due to be replaced by a 12-month package worth $5 billion. The Treasury declined to comment on the Telegraph report. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. Charlie will be back in around 30 minutes' time to continue to keep us updated. Let's talk data now, because it has certainly been the story of the day. We're going to start with Europe, the Eurozone, CPI inflation data out a little bit earlier on. Now, at a headline level, inflation comes down quite sharply in December. We come down from 10.1 to 9.2. Economists were expecting 9.5. But here's the kicker. Core inflation, which strips out energy, actually increased. Increased from 5 to 5.2. And the fear now is that that is the number that the ECB is going to focus on. Despite economic deceleration, the ECB is going to focus on that data and continue to hike reasonably aggressively. Let's get Marcus Ashworth's take on this. I can't speak tonight. It's been a long week.
It's okay.
Speaking is hard, as Alex Steele would say. Mm-hmm. Marcus, which of those two numbers should Christine Lagarde and Co. be looking at?
Well, it doesn't matter what I think they should be looking at, it's what they're unfortunately going to be looking at. And you're right to emphasise the core, but I think that's the wrong way to look at it, because the fact that the headline is dropping so much is going to front-run everything, as it did on the way up, it will on the way down. And by focusing myopically on the core without, you know, looking through these numbers, the ECB is running the risk of making yet another policy error. And, you know, I think inflation is starting to dramatically turn down in the States. It's clearly now on the same trajectory in Europe. One of these days you might get it in the UK, you never know. But the point is that with the forward-looking indicators, we can see the oil price, the gas price, this is going to carry on going on. We're seeing stickiness in services, particularly in Europe, and industrial goods, that's non-energy related industrial goods, as you would expect. Food prices, a little bit firm. I mean, you've got food, alcohol, tobacco, 13.8. That isn't great. I appreciate that. But they will come down because what drove them up in the first place, i.e. energy prices, have fallen like a rock and will continue to fall like a rock. Now, we're building inventory in gas during the winter months, unheard of. So as far as that's concerned, I don't think going into next winter or even throughout the next rest of 2023, I think anything like the same pressure or problems we're going to have as we did in 2022. That's a big thing for me to say, but I'm pretty confident that as far as the energy crisis is concerned, it's basically over.
Well, okay, fair enough. But my question is the core part of the inflation read. That's not going to be energy. Where in the core did we see the stickiness? Like, how are you convinced that services part's going to roll over?
Well, services up a little bit. Overall, the core is up, but it's up very small amount. I mean, that's what gives me the confidence that is that we are going to see it roll over. It's going to take some while. People will fret, but that's the reason we have 1,000+ economists sitting in this tower in Frankfurt to try and see these things ahead of time. You know, we know how inflation works. We were expecting core to lift. It has lifted. The fact it's starting to sort of, you know, not accelerate and at quite the same degree is it's going to by the summer that it will have turned down. And we should be able to look through these things. I'm not saying that means cut interest rates. I mean, don't load on 50 after 50 after 50 in hiking because you're going to push Europe into recession. And we will have deceleration and deflation.
The market's currently thinking, or the kind of the expectation is 3.5 is where the ECB kind of tops out. How far above, kind of, where does a policy mistake start? Is it 3%? Is it 3.25? Is it 3.5? What do you think the right number should be vis-a-vis that 3.5?
I mean, seriously, I think that...
So they just stop now?
Well, and actually, I think they should be stopping certainly no more than another 50. I expect them to probably do possibly another 100 from here. I think that would be a mistake. I think they'll realise it quite quickly. If they were talking about another 150 to 200, as some of the more hawkish ones, I think will be an absolute disaster for the European economy. You've got to look at things like money supply, it's collapsing. They are not just hiking interest rates, they're also collapsing the balance sheet with regards to the super cheap loans in the banking sector, and they're doing QT, just as everyone else is really building up in QT. The Fed's QT is really starting to accelerate, and we know what the Bank of England are doing as well. All this combined means it drains money globally, and I'm not sure the European economy particularly can handle it.
And at that wonderful note, I'm going to say goodbye, Guy. He's running to catch a train.
Next week, back to normal.
So you say. I'll believe it when I see it. Good luck getting home. I know it was a terrible train ride in. So good luck. Have a good weekend. And we will see you on Monday. Marcus, you're sticking with me just for a bit. So then how does that compare to the Fed versus the ECB? If the economy gets tough on both ends, will the Fed be more able to cut than the ECB will, or vice versa?
Well, I mean, the Fed is in a better situation, always has been and will continue to be. I do think there are some quite clear signs of we say, flashing amber recession signs in the States.
Really? Even after today's data?
Yeah, I think there is some particularly in ISM services. Mm-hmm. I think there's also some of the shift in wages is very interesting to me because it looks to me like we're broadening out. It's a change in the wage market away from high-end, high-bonus jobs to filling out lower-paid, less remunerated jobs, which is both good and bad, depending how you want to look at it. Mm-hmm. But certainly, as far as the Fed's concerned, I think there's some positive signs. It doesn't have to worry so much about wage inflation, but that's because the economy is definitely softening, I think. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get a recession in the States, but they're going to flirt with it, I think. Mm. But this is all good news for the ECB, because the Fed turns over quicker, until the Fed starts going down to 25 and then the Fed pauses, until then, the ECB can't give up. And I hope for the ECB that the Fed front runs them and makes their life easier.
So basically, the Fed will be able to stop before the ECB, and that will give the ECB a lifeline to stop hiking Correct. Into weakness. But the Fed has to stop hiking first. Now, to me, the data, though, says, okay, slow but solid, but like what I said in the beginning of the program, in which case it feels like maybe they can downshift to 25, for example. Would that help at all?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. I think, but I just don't think the ECB can do it mm-hmm. until the Fed does it.
Until the Fed totally has to stop. 50 or 25 doesn't really matter.
Well, no. The Fed goes to 25, the ECB can think about doing 25. Mm. The Fed goes to stop, then and only then can the ECB. Because bear in mind, they started late. They started in July this year, and they're from a much, much lower level. But, you know, yes, they got some catching up to do because their inflation rate was a lot higher. But, you know, we just got to realize the European economy is not like the US. It doesn't have anything like the strength. And it really does not need to be whacked into recession because that will drag inflation down to as I mentioned earlier, we're going to start talking about deflation if not careful.
So let's go into, we're going to touch more on the jobs data and what it means for the US. But I do want to get your take before I let you go because, I, you know, I got to send you off on your Friday in about 5 minutes. When you take a look at the numbers for today, it does feel like this could start setting the stage for a soft landing. Wages slowing a bit, unemployment rate still perplexingly low, even though more people are coming into the labor force. It feels like this is a new kind of Goldilocks. This is what everyone's kind of been saying the last few hours. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes-ish. I mean, and that's why, I mean, I'm not surprised to see that the front end collapsed so much because it sort of needed to, really, because it was mm-hmm. it's overpriced. But it's telling you, but whatever Kashkari wants to say at 5.4 terminal, that ain't happening. I don't think we'll get to 5. Hmm. And I think that's not just because the dynamic of the Fed FOMC makeup has changed, you know, four more, much more dovish voices coming in. But I just think, you know, you can see very clearly inflation's turn in the States. Yes, of course, everyone's worrying about the next thing, which might be, for instance, core inflation, or it might be, you know, labor, you know, wages. But I mean, these are sort of secondary concerns. The worst is over. It might last for longer. Yes, mm-hmm. there is a risk we could get a second upsurge in inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But that's telling me time to pause, not time to keep on hiking.
And not time to cut either, hence the pause. And that's when I was bringing up too. What's that?
Forget cutting. I think we've got a long way to go. But it will come at some point, possibly by the end of the year.
Well, and that brings up the point that Guy kept talking about on television, which is an interesting one, that if you wind up having a low jobless rate and consistently low jobless rate, so U3 under 4, for example, if inflation does wind up coming down, A, is that even possible? And B, does that automatically look at inflation resurgence? Once growth picks up, if unemployment's so low, boom, higher prices again.
I don't see it because of the labor participation rate. I don't see it because, you know, there's 5 million missing people, you know, out of the workforce, you know, proportionally, you know, in the sense of be that partly immigration changed since the pandemic, but there is 5 million, you know, washing around in the system, which haven't sort of shown up, should we say, in the labor data. There is more slack in the US employment market, I think, than the Fed is prepared to admit. It won't admit it, but I'm certain it's aware of it. And it's exactly the same what's going on in the UK.
That's interesting. So there is more slack. We're just not really seeing it yet.
Yeah, and I think that's where we're starting to see, you know, pick up on labor participation rate from time to time and things like that. There are some stuff. It looks horrifically tight and it looks a nightmare. But, you know, we're seeing a rollover in wages. That tells me that there is, and, you know, other things coming down like jolts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's definitely a very firm market. It's a great economy in that sense. But there is a lot of other signs showing you that in the next few months there will be, should we say, some give in the labor market. And finally, that unemployment rate will rise up. But by that stage, it's sort of too late. You know what I mean? Because that's when you're talking into recession.
So before I let you go, we were talking about the bond market. And clearly, it definitely seems like the U.S. is leading the big moves in the bond market. You're now looking at the 2-year yield down 17 basis points. You mentioned some of that's going to be re-rating because there'd been a sell-off in the bond market. Well, how much more do you think this move has right now?
That's a very searching question. I don't know, is the honest answer. It's clearly got some momentum behind it. It's clearly the market is repricing for a Fed terminal rate way lower than the Fed's still trying to talk about. You know, we're talking mid fours, should we say, rather than fives. And that's something which, you know, is probably driving everything. Probably we've got a little bit more to go on that. Personally, I think with the uptick in quantitative tightening, the debt ceiling debate coming up, A raft of new issues is going to come out. I think it's going to hit into some quite heavy headwinds, this current rally. I don't think it will last forever. And we will have, you know, we're in a range, and I think we will tick back up again. But we may have a little bit further to go to the downside first.
And with that, Marcus, I let you go enjoy your weekend. Thank you so very much for helping me out this week when Guy was dealing with the train strikes. I really appreciate it. Marcus Ashworth of Bloomberg Opinion. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at Shell, A, because it's oil and I get to talk about it and Guy's not here, and also did a trading update. Really interesting. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson's running to catch a train, so he's not here, so I get to talk about oil. In particular, Shell. So the stock over in London closed up about 1.6%. We had some news today. The company said its gas trading earnings were, quote, significantly higher in the final 3 months of 2022, as the unit did really, really well and overcame some of the challenges that it had earlier in the year when it comes to its trading unit. We also saw a lot more about what they said about LNG as well as production, and we'll get to that in just a moment. So joining me to break it all down, Bloomberg Renewable Energy and Climate Change reporter Will Mathis. What did you make of the gas trading earnings?
Yeah, so it looks like they figured out whatever was going wrong in the third quarter when, you know, the third quarter was great quarter for Shell, but the trading, gas trading, you know, they'd gotten some bets wrong. And while BP and Exxon saw gas trading really, you know, send their profits up to really incredible levels, Shell was kind of the back of the pack there. And they said that they had some, you know, they made some bad moves, and whatever happened was figured out. And It looks like it's back on track in the fourth quarter.
So what's the outlook for this year for the company? Because as a new CEO, which is a huge deal, I'm going to say the name wrong, Wael Swan, is that correct?
That's pretty good.
He's like, it's close enough for you. We'll give it a pass. So he took over just a few days ago. So this is going to be a big year. What's in store for Shell?
He took over, and he was previously running the gas unit. So that's, you know, investors will be happy to see that, you know, the spot where he was previously in charge is doing well. And what's in store for them? I mean, global energy markets were extremely volatile last year, and it's very likely that that's going to be the case again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have factors like potential recession. You have China reopening or trying to reopen that could see a lot of new demand if that, you know, does come around. And you also have, you know, the war, Russia's war in Ukraine continuing, and that's, you know, gas flows from Russia to Europe have, you know, fallen incredibly and could completely stop other than LNG. And that's just going to continue to add volatility that companies like Shell can take advantage of and also potentially send prices back up later this year.
So do companies like this like the volatility? Like, does it help them make decisions because they can benefit from these price spikes, for example? Or does it make their job of hedging, of where they allocate, does it just make that really hard for them?
Definitely they like when the price goes up a lot.
Yeah, they like that part of it.
It doesn't cost them more to, you know, pump the oil and gas out of the ground. And, you know, a company like Shell, especially with gas, you know, they're one of the biggest LNG, have one of the biggest LNG businesses. You know, they helped start that trade, you know, years ago, and it's really paying off now that LNG is in such high demand in Europe and prices have, you know, reached record levels, and that's great for them. And with volatility, you know, it lets their trading desks really shine if they can and, you know, make a lot of money.
Yep, fair enough. In terms of how Shell is positioning for the future, I was having this conversation with someone earlier that there's this chronic underinvestment in the oil patch, yet we still need oil and gas. We know this, right? But the the real money going forward for these guys isn't going to be made in renewables. They're going to have to buy the assets just because to say that they have them. But also the real money is going to be made in power and the money in power trading. And you got to have the renewable assets to then trade in that market. But that's going to be the real moneymaker and the real differentiator. What are you hearing in relation to how these guys shape up going forward?
Yeah, well, they are figuring it out. They, you know, I think that that's a big question for Shell. They are have some plans, at least in name, to, you know, reach net zero emissions by 2050 across their business. Mm-hmm. So they want to grow in power and leverage their trading ability to make money there. But it's, you know, it is a question mark if they can translate their success with oil and gas into power. And if you look at, you know, the big renewables companies, they don't have the margins that mm-hmm. Shell has. And it's not really clear where Shell will be able to invent those margins from.
Yeah. In the meantime, the governments in the world have been sort of after nice, juicy profits from commodity companies. It's not necessarily just a Europe or a UK issue in terms of windfall taxes. This is kind of across the board. How are they managing having to pay out more? Because I have to imagine if the governments are coming in and asking for more of their money, that's going to also raise their cost of doing business and raise their break evens, which then creates a lot of other drama. Where are we with that?
Well, in Europe and UK, you know, there have been windfall taxes imposed, and Shell said that its 2022 windfall tax burden in the UK and Europe will be something like $2.4 billion. So, you know, there's no way around that. They have avoided some tax burden in the UK by making investments that offset how much they would have to pay, but they're going to pay that and continue, at least in the UK and potentially more in Europe, depending on what governments do to try and take profits from those companies that are really benefiting to help pay for the pain experienced by the rest of their populations.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting to see how this all winds up playing out when Big Oil also runs reporting over the next few weeks as well. I'm obviously looking at Exxon and Chevron, totally talking my U.S. book on that. So again, the news there, Shell and its gas trading earnings were significantly higher in the final 3 months of 2022. So figured out any trading glitches that they had. Also, just a couple little highlights here. The output of their LNG, liquefied natural gas, in the fourth quarter was between 6.6 million and 7 million tons. It was sequentially a little bit down. They had some problems with some of their projects over in Australia, but still pretty solid. Their refining margins rose about 27%. Chemical margins also did really well. And overall integrated production for gas was up a little bit. All right, this is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. We're seeing a really powerful rally continuing to gain some momentum here within the United States. About 93% of S&P stocks rise. You had slow but solid. That's how I'm categorizing it when it comes to the ISM services, below 50 but still strong. And jobs holding up, even though wages coming down. Some might disagree, but that's at least how the markets are taking it. Yields continuing their climb lower. Their climb lower? Can you climb lower? I don't think you can, considering their journey lower. How about that? Let's say it like this. That's a snapshot here in the U.S. Let's get some more with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Junior doctors in England will consider walking out for 72 hours in March as health unions remain at loggerheads with the U.K. government over pay. The British Medical Association says it will call the three-day strike so long as its members vote to take action in a ballot that goes out on Monday. One of the nation's biggest mortgage lenders says UK house prices are on track to drop 8% this year, the first annual drop since 2011, after declining for 4 months in a row. Halifax said its measure of property prices fell 1.5% last month after a 2.4% decline in November. Bet365 Group founder Denise Coates was paid about £272 million last year, retaining her title as one of the world's best-paid executives positives, even as her gambling empire's earnings slumped. The online bookmaker's 55-year-old majority shareholder and co-CEO got about £58 million from dividends, as well as a £213 million salary for her work at the business for the year through March 2022, according to a UK registry filing. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie Pellett, thank you so very much. So next week for earnings in the U.S., we're going to kick off big bank earnings. That happens on Friday. So a lot of attention is going to be paid towards trading activity. What kind of volatility were they able to capitalize on? What it means for FIC, what it winds up meaning for credit trading, bond trading, commodities trading, equities trading, you name it. That's part of the story. Now, to get sort of an inside view of that, Guy and I, as well as Shanali Basak, spoke to Tradeweb and the new CEO, Billy Hult. He's been at the company for about 14 years as president. He newly minted CEO. He took the reins just a couple days ago. It's an electronic trading platform that all these big guys wind up using. And here's part of this conversation.
Last year was really almost like a tale of two stories. There was the first half of the year, actually, there were really robust volumes across the board. And then the second half of the year, as you guys know really well, I think volatility got to a place where there became kind of liquidity concerns around a couple of the core fixed income markets, the government bond market, the TBA mortgage market, to say two. And then, to your point, Sonali, at the very end of the year in December, we felt like we really got back to a little bit of what I would describe as a sort of normal or natural cadence around fixed income trading. Volumes rebounded really well in government bonds, TBA mortgages, global swaps, and really we saw really significant volumes in an important market, the high yield credit market and the IG credit market. So we feel really good about kind of where we're sitting now. Early January. We think this is a really good and beneficial market towards fixed income trading activity. And I'm excited, sort of my first week as CEO of the company. And thanks very much for having me on.
You know, that fixed income boom that you're seeing, is it across the board? Is it unanimous? Or are there places where it'll take a while for pockets of activity to come back?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really like, you know, these markets are all so different and they're different enough in very specific ways that it's rarely like across the board green light, green light. And so you definitely have different markets responding differently amongst this environment. I would say the mortgage market still has a way to go in terms of how it's functioning, in terms of volumes getting back to where they were, but really, really strong and good news about the credit markets. And for us, kind of across the board, really all through last year, and we're really feeling very bullish about our ETF trading activity. We think that's a market that's really kind of in green light mode.
Hey, Billy, it's good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I'm a commodity nerd, so this is a little bit biased, but anyone in the commodity market is going to tell you that commodities are trading poorly. There's not enough liquidity. There's not enough interest in trading the commodity world. What are you seeing in actuality? What does it look like?
Yeah, I think the commodity market has been, you know, absolutely struggling. And there's aspects, you know, of the commodity market. I'm kind of a little bit of a mortgage nerd, so we're kind of nerds together. There are aspects of the commodities market that sort of are a little bit remind me of what's happening, you know, in the mortgage market, where it just feels like it's a little bit of a one-way trade, and it's a little bit of a dark moment. I think both of these businesses, the commodities business in general, and obviously the mortgage market, have lots of history around resiliency. So I do feel like long-term, both of these markets are going to have better days. But I definitely would agree with you that we're in a challenging moment around both of those businesses.
Billy, if you're a mortgage nerd, good morning, it's Guy. Talk me through what your expectations are for the U.S. housing market this year.
You know, it's hard to be overly kind of bullish on kind of housing with this level of kind of uncertainty. My general instinct is back to the sort of, you know, the way that market trades is, you know, it's important to get more market makers in that business. As you guys know really well, the European banks have historically been very strong in the mortgage market. The Credit Suisses, the Deutsche Banks, the UBSs, et cetera, they've kind of receded from that business over the last few years. And I do think it's important that the mortgage market evolves from just the JP Morgans, the Goldmans, the banks, Bank of America's, the Citi's, and the Morgan Stanley's, and there becomes more participants in that market. And in some ways, it winds up mimicking some of the evolution that's happened in the government bond market, where you have more of the high-frequency firms participating and adding liquidity to that business.
Hey, Billy.
I think that will help the market and housing.
You mentioned liquidity being a concern at times, and we haven't seen the worst of it. That's the reality when it comes to tightening, as far as quantitative tightening. So how much is liquidity still a concern? And I'd love for you to get specific on where it could become mostly a concern.
I was sort of watching your guys' show a ton, not surprisingly, during the pandemic, and it was really interesting just to see how the government bond market became kind of like frontline news around how that market is operating, right? What are the bid covers when someone's trying to sell? There's a buyer. What is the price below the buyer? How is the market really operating on a moment-to-moment basis? And those are the really kind of important things, right? Like, there's all this evolution that's happened through electronic trading, but at the end of the day, a seller needs a buyer. A buyer needs a seller. And these markets need to operate at a very high level for the whole system to work. My general feeling is there's been some, like, very interesting, I know you had PIMCO on just before me. There's been very interesting news, for example, in the government bond market about two things. One is the evolution of all-to-all trading in government bonds, and the other is, you know, real news around the potential of central clearing in government bonds. My general instinct is those are two really strong developments around this concern and issue around liquidity, and Tradeweb is very supportive of both.
That was Billy Hult, the CEO of Tradeweb. It was a really fascinating conversation. He also had lots of fun opinions about going back to work and Wall Street getting their butts back in the office. He's like, if you're at home watching this right now and you work for Tradeweb, go back to the office. So it's nice and refreshing to have somebody say that. Just as we were playing that for you, I just want to focus on Tom Barkin. He is giving a speech and answering some reporter questions. And he's saying things like, you need to keep forward-looking real rates positive. Of course, he's focusing on inflation, not necessarily the absolute level of Fed funds rate, really looking at the recent inflation trends that we've seen. Anyway, that just is adding on to the Fed speak that we've seen over the last few hours. We'll get you more on that in just a moment. Okay, coming up, we're going to go to D.C. in the fascinating takedown of want-to-be House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. We are on the 12th vote. We'll get the latest. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Okay, let's get to D.C. here. The 12th vote is underway for Speaker of the House. Kevin McCarthy does not have enough votes as of yet. Let's get the latest count here. Laura Davison, congressional reporter for Bloomberg, joins us now. What's the count? What are the negotiations like?
Well, the count is literally changing as we speak. They're voting one by one on the floor. But we did see the first sign of progress in the 4 days of talks. Two members, Dan Bishop and Breakin, both changed their vote. They had previously opposed McCarthy and now are supporting McCarthy. This is the result of some late talks last night where they detailed more rules changes to the House procedures, gave some of these members, some of the things they were asking for regarding the budget, regarding committee assignments. The details of this deal are still being worked out. There was a call this morning with all Republicans and unclear exactly how many support this deal, but this is at least a sign a sign of progress for McCarthy.
So do we know what he gives up, though, is the ability for one person to have basically a vote of no confidence for him? Doesn't that basically just effectively neuter that position forever?
It really makes it very difficult for this person to govern. So the rule change here for saying that any single person could call, any single Republican could call, that's only in effect for 2 years. Okay. It's something that could change going forward. But once you set that precedent, it's really hard going forward. And, you know, McCarthy or whoever is Speaker is going to have that axe over their head every single move they make.
Yeah, I mean, at some point I was Peggy Noonan wrote, I think it was in the Journal. Yeah, it was in the Journal today, that basically at some point you step aside for the good of the country and you just do what's best, not just what you want. Is there any indication that that will happen for Kevin McCarthy, or is this just going to be, election by 1,000 paper cuts?
This is really kind of the question of the day, and there's starting to be some rumblings from some moderate Republicans and even some, you know, more middle-of-the-road mainline Republicans who are concerned that McCarthy has given up too much and that the next 2 years are just going to be completely ungovernable. The Speaker is going to have no power, and they're basically going to be held hostage, these 20 or so hardliners who are requesting these changes.
So so where does it then go from here? Like, if we have two members now over to his side, so how many more does he actually then need? And then the consistent concessions. If the moderate Republicans get mad at that, what do they do?
So we are up to four who have now switched just in the time that we've been talking. So the news is shifting quickly. But what's important to know here, McCarthy has 20 who are against him. He can only lose four. So there's, you know, 16 more or so that he needs to win over. So it's very difficult math for him going forward. There's some games that can be played if some members vote present that don't want to vote for him, but want this to end. That could happen. It's unclear that today is going to be the day that this gets decided. Already members are signaling this could spill into the weekend.
Well, so what happens over the next 48 hours?
So they'll continue to vote. Basically, the House can do two things right now. They can either vote for Speaker, you know, where all the members have to be there, sit in their chair, stand up and announce their vote, or they can motion to adjourn. Democrats have been not willing to give Republicans votes to motion to adjourn. They want them to go through this process. At some point, everyone gets tired. And, you know, like last night around 9:30 or 8:30 or so, they wrapped it up. But the schedule here has been so in flux, no one really knows minute to minute what's going to happen. But really, the action on the floor is sort of the sideshow. Where the real action is down in these conference rooms in the Capitol. Members are hashing out this deal, and that's where we'll see the progress, and if there is more progress going forward today.
Do we, in essence, have a 2-, 3-, or 4-party system in the U.S. right now?
Well, right now, there's essentially three parties that are important, or three factions of people that are important in the Capitol right now. You have Democrats, they control the Senate. You have Republicans, and they're really split. You have sort of the majority of Republicans, Kevin McCarthy being the head of that group. And then the more conservative Republicans, sometimes called the House Freedom Caucus. And because of the really tight majorities that Republicans in the House have, they're a very important voice. We spent a lot of the past 2 years talking about how Joe Manchin and his wants and needs were controlling Democrats in the Senate. That's really the same situation we now have here in the House.
I mean, I guess after us making so much fun of you guys over in the UK, I can't blame you for not making fun of us, to be honest. Laura, thanks a lot. Laura Davison joining us there. Coming up, we'll get back to the Fed. We'll get back to the markets. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Okay, let's get to the jobs number here and just go through some and recap some of the highlights. You had the U.S. economy adding 223,000 jobs, the unemployment rate falling to 3.5%. On the upside, you had average hourly earnings year-on-year basis falling to 4.6%, the labor force participation rate ticking up just a little bit. And then fast forward about an hour and a half, and we get the ISM services data. So that actually falling below 50 for the first time since May of 2020, the employment below 50, so prices and services paid finally rolling over, and new orders firmly around 45. So all of that leads you to an equity rally and a sell-off in the bond market. So let's get to it with Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist. Is all of this, Ira, worth the 18 bips we're seeing on the two-year?
Yeah, I think it's so much of the market, and I talked to you about this before, Alex, is about positioning. And there were a lot of people who were saying, oh, the Fed's still going to be hiking. They're going to hike another, 75, 80 basis points, and that means, or 100 basis points, and that means that two-year yields need to be somewhat higher. Now, our estimate of fair value for two-year yields is around 4.5%. Of course, that was before some of the data that we saw. So it's not a huge surprise to me that going into the weekend, people want to, maybe take off some short positions, wind up, going in flat. So I do think that a lot of this is just people getting out of their flattening positions, mm-hmm. and people getting out of their short end positions.
Okay, so my read through was like, oh, well, look, you have the market that thinks now the Fed can kind of downshift. Is there any truth to that interpretation?
Yeah, so I do think, I mean, we've been thinking for a month or so now, basically since the last Fed meeting, that that the Fed would try to downshift to 25 basis points. So the way that I describe it is, I think the Fed now is in calibration mode. So they're close enough to where they want to get to that, and they're not sure if it should be 5% or 5.25% or 5.5%, that they can downshift to 25 basis point moves now and then wait to see how the economy develops over the next 3 to 6 months before they ultimately stop hiking interest rates. I do think what's really interesting, and one of the big reasons why two-year yields have been selling off, is not because the market's pricing out significant hikes in January or March, but what it's done is it said, okay, we think they're going to cut interest rates more later in the year. So instead of only a 25 basis point or 30 basis points of cuts being priced, now we're pricing in two full cuts by the end of the year. And that's basically, I think, the market's acknowledgement that, hey, the Fed's almost done, but we're going to have a weaker economy than we thought later in the year.
But is the data pointing to that? A weaker economy later in the year?
Well, certainly pointing to a slowdown. I mean, when you look the forward-looking indicators, and look, ISM services, someone asked me, an investor asked me last year, look, if you only had one data to choose from to determine where the economy's going forever and then, what would you be using? And I said it would be ISM new orders, because it almost always is a significant leading indicator for the markets. And if those data, if the services numbers or the ISM manufacturing new orders numbers go below 45, that's a signal that we're going to be in a recession over the next couple of quarters. And both of them right now are at 45 or 45.2 in the ISM services that new orders came out this morning. So we're very close to recession territory and signaling for recession. So even if we do have a soft landing, it's going to feel very much like a recession. I point this to Alex, like 1994 was the one time maybe you could point to where you had a soft landing, where the Fed engineered that, but it was still felt very much like a recession. I can say that because I had a problem finding a job back then. So,
fair enough.
it's going to feel like a lot like a recession, even if NBR doesn't say it is.
Fair enough. And if it quacks like a duck, it is a duck, even if it doesn't say it's a duck. I mean, at the end of the day, you can make that argument. So with this all in mind, what kind of bond environment are we going to be in now? Like, are we going to have a reset and then back to the old normal? Are we going to have a new normal? Are we going to have the world where bonds make you returns? Like, what's it going to be?
Yeah, well, I think we're, because of how drastic the sell-off was in 2022, I think now you're going to have a bit less of the, everything is moving in the same direction. So, we had the quantitative easing trade, which was, bonds rally and equities rally. And then you had the last year was the quantitative tightening trade, where bonds sell off and equities sell off. So I think, now with the likelihood that once the Fed starts to cut, they're going to stop quantitative tightening and probably not be doing quantitative easing, that we'll get back into the normal environment where, equities rally significantly and you wind up having bond market maybe sell off because of the idea that you'll have a decent economy. So I do think that we'll get back to that normality at some point during the course of this year. I think for right now, the rate market really is probably going to be range bound for the next 3, 4, 5 months, just because until we get a better direction of where the economy is actually headed, the market's just going to be playing all of these numbers, and you're just going to see a lot of volatility with not a lot of direction.
Right, which to your point, positioning into the numbers and then the move that we're seeing right now. Do you think we see a five handle on the 2-year at some point in this whippy world?
I don't. Like I said, I think 4.5% is about fair value given where we think that the Fed's going to hike to 5.25% and kind of leave it there for the rest of the year. So I think we're probably in the 2-year in a trading range between, call it, broadly speaking, 4% to 4.25%, 4.5%. 4.25%, probably the midpoint of whatever range we end up in. And, the 10-year is interesting, too, because we had that big sell-off at the end of the year, and now we've rallied back significantly. So 340 to 390, I think, is a range that will probably hold again for the next few months at least. And then, once we get additional information, additional data, maybe then we'll start to trend a little bit. And I think more than likely we'll rally in the 10-year, before the end of this year.
So what are you looking for next week? We don't have a ton of time, but what's going to be like an indicator for you?
Well, it's obviously CPI. I mean, that's the only number really next week that's going to matter.
So CPI, okay. And you think the trade's going to be what? You think we're going to be anticipating a bit of a rollover?
Yeah, I think that if we wind up getting numbers where the year-on-year figure gets below 6.5%, we're going to see a pretty good rally, particularly in that front end of the curve. And I think we test 4% on the two-year in a pretty quick fashion.
Awesome stuff. Ira, I love it. I love how you get me so jazzed about the bond market. That's like one of the things I like best most about you. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Ira Jersey of Bloomberg Intelligence. Well, that was a week. It was only 4 days, but it felt like a month. Guys, have a great weekend. We will catch you back here on Monday, a busy week next week, earnings and CPI. This is Bloomberg.